So we're going to finish out talking about a couple other clinical issues. And to get into that, Eric, I'd like to hear about your 56-year-old lady.
Yes, this was a lady with a family history of colon cancer, and she presented with blood loss, changes in stool patterns, and cramps. Sigmoid adenocarcinoma was found with bilobar synchronous liver metastasis and also stenosis on the colonoscopy. So therefore, we decided to go initially for a resection of the sigmoid. Further workup showed a KRAS exon 2 mutation, a BRAF wild-type tumor, which was microsatellite stable. So after the operation, a couple of weeks after the operation, we started her with the first-line chemotherapy. We started with FOLFOX-BEV. She had initial stable disease, but developed polyneuropathy grade 2, and then was continued with the maintenance treatment of 5-FU-BEV. And after a couple of months already, she was progressive in the liver and the lungs. And because of the persisting neuropathy, she was then switched. Remember, she had the KRAS mutation to FOLFIRI-BEV with a nice response initially, quite long persisting response for 1 year. The metastases were unresectable. She was in good condition. And then at that moment, she became progressive again. And then we had to decide for further treatment. And we decided to start her with regorafenib at a dose of 120 milligrams, 3 weeks on, 1 week off.
Before you go on, I'm kind of curious, would you still start that dose today if you had her? Are you still using 120 as your starting dose?
Yeah, the official approved dose is under 60 milligrams. In patients, I never start under 60 milligrams. In patients in good condition, which she was relatively young, good organ function, I would start under 20 milligrams. And if there is no toxicity, then we would go up. I usually don't start with 80 milligrams, like in the redose study that's presented recently by Tony Saab, usually with under 20 milligrams.
So second opinion from you, Wells, what dose do you usually start regorafenib?
For someone who's young and otherwise healthy and, you know, doing well and has tolerated other therapies well, I often start at 120. If there's any doubt, I'll start them at 80 and kind of work my way up. It can get a little confusing for patients when you're kind of messing around with the doses and do this for a week and then something else for a week and then something else for a week. So I try to keep it simple and start at 120.
The patient actually ended up getting TAS 102 also, but I'm kind of curious, Eric, why did you start regorafenib as opposed to TAS 102 at that point?
Well, I have patients that I start with trifluridine tipiracil, as we call it, TAS 102. And patients I start with regorafenib, we don't have good parameters to select. Both drugs cross-trial comparisons have a similar efficacy, have a different safety profile. Regorafenib 160 is clearly too toxic. In this patient, the reason why we decided that was she was young, good condition. We said we will have chances if she doesn't respond to one of the two drugs, we will have a chance to switch to the other one. So that was probably the reasoning in this situation why we started with regorafenib. If I would see the patient and if she was started already or got an advice in another center to start with trifluridine tipiracil, I would not overrule that in this situation. So both are options.
This seems like a pretty common type of scenario, Wells. How do you decide which one to start with? I've heard this logic of if the patient's in good shape, let's get the regorafenib in first. But how do you make that decision?
Basically, I find it's often in part decided by prior toxicity. So when people have some neuropathy from FOLFOX, that hand-foot syndrome can be really bothersome. On the other hand, if they've had a lot of issues with blood counts, there I'm going to probably use regorafenib because, you know, TAS has higher blood counts and in my experience a little bit higher fatigue. So a lot of times it's really based on what are the kind of chronic toxicities. When you talk it over with patients, what do they really want to avoid? What's going to bother them more? I think it's so interesting that, you know, here we have this very similar drug in terms of being in sort of the 5-FU family. I know it's a different drug, but it's so interesting to me that they seem to have engineered a lot of the mucositis and the hand-foot syndrome. You just don't see that as much. I think it's very interesting. There's some biologic reasons why that might be, but I find fatigue and blood counts are really the key things with TAS 102.
Interesting. So I was really struck by your case, Eric, because the first time I heard about cavitation with regorafenib was actually from you a few years ago. And that's what happened with this patient. Can you talk about what happened there?
Yeah, we saw indeed cavitation. That means that if you see lung metastasis, that the central area of the lung metastasis becomes black. So there's necrosis. And we have seen that as well in the CORRECT study, as in our patients in Leuven. We looked in retrospectively in many patients, and we saw that that correlates with a response. So if you see cavitation in the lung, then these patients usually do respond better. Of course, that's not a real predictive factor, because you see it only after you've started the treatment. But once you see it in a patient who is doing fine, that's an extra argument that she may benefit on longer term. That's similar to what you see with trifluridine tipiracil. When you see also neutropenia, that's also correlated with a longer benefit. Again, not a real predictive factor. You have it only after you've treated the patients. But that's also another argument, and that are for sure not reasons to stop regorafenib when you have cavitation or trifluridine tipiracil when you have neutropenia.
What do you think the pathophysiology of the cavitation is, Eric? And do you see complications like bleeding?
We have never seen complications and in the patients like bleeding, and in the patients who were treated in the CORRECT study and other centers that we reported also, we haven't seen complications. The mechanism is probably necrosis. You see also with bevacizumab in the liver sometimes these vascular changes. In the lungs, I've seen it a couple of times, but to a clearly lesser extent with bevacizumab compared to with regorafenib.
So let's go through a couple scenarios that we presented to the audience. Wells, first of all, a patient with a pan-RAS right-sided lesion who gets FOLFOX-BEV, FOLFIRI-BEV, and then has disease progression. And it looks like most of the audience would be thinking about an EGFR antibody, but a fair number, regorafenib or TAS-102. Any comments about this scenario, Wells?
Yeah, so for right-sided, it's a little unclear as to whether what we found in 80405, which is that it's basically harmful to use an EGFR inhibitor in that setting. We don't know if the same is true in the second or third line setting. My own opinion would just be that until we have further data, I'm just not going to use it, because I certainly wouldn't want to harm someone, especially at a cost of several thousand dollars every week. So I tend to avoid it, but we really don't know for sure if somehow the signaling patterns in the tumor change such that it may work better in the second or third line setting. So in this situation, I would tend to go more for regorafenib or TAS.
Yeah, in the ESMO guidelines, we stated clearly, and that's based also on some data, that the data for sidedness, that they are only valid and proven in first line. So in a third line scenario, like here in this patient, where if it's right-sided, we think that the benefit of cetuximab is identical, a relative benefit in the right side versus the left side. So in other words, the sidedness in later lines is for us not an argument to refrain from an EGFR antibody. So I would clearly vote in this situation for cetuximab irinotecan.